Okay, thanks for that SI announcement. So I just want to say one more time, this is Bio 241, and it is September 1st. And you notice that we have a test next week on Thursday, but we do have lecture on Tuesday because it's not a holiday. Monday is a holiday, but we don't have class. So we still have a full week next week. But anyway, if you have a class on Monday, don't come to school because you'll be about the only person on campus, right? Because everybody else is home studying like crazy. All right, so we're supposed to have this chapter and then chapter 3 on the first test, and we're just a little bit behind, so you're going to have to come to lecture to find out what will be on the test or if I'm going to push the test off or whatever. I'm not sure. I can't make up my mind right now. So, huh? Well, you know, I'd love to push it off, but that means we have to continue school until spring semester, and I'm not going to be able to talk you guys into that, right? So we do have to finish the class on time, unfortunately. All right, so we were talking about this slide last time, so I'm going to get the lights working in just a little second. Let's see, what do I want to do? Sorry, I just had a lot of questions before class. I'll turn these lights down, and this is looking good. That's even going to look better like that. And I think if I go like this, I think the only thing I'm going to show you today are PowerPoint slides, so I'm going to project on both screens. I don't want to show you the periodic table, but that would be nice. I think during the test, I'll just project the periodic table up on the screen for you, or maybe I'll give you a hard copy. I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. If I give you a hard copy, then you'll be able to write notes on it and, you know, calculations and things like that. But just like the calculators you can't share during an exam. The periodic table you cannot share either during the exam, right? Especially if you write little notes on it, like how to calculate pH and things like that. Yeah. No. So I'll give you a scratch sheet, or I'll pass it out after I pass out all the tests. So that will take a little bit to get all the tests out. Yeah. And then I want you to return to me after the test your little scribble sheet, and then I'll check you off to make sure that you turn that back in. All right, so don't forget, for the test, you need a picture ID, Fullerton or Cypress College picture ID, and you need a calculator, basic scientific non-graphing calculator, pencil, paper, and an 8A2 ES Scantron, which has 100 questions on it, 50 on the front, 50 on the back. I would stay away from the 8A2 Lovas Scantron, because those are the ones that have the answers bubbled in already with a little bit of a gray background, and my Scantron reader sometimes takes a guess at what your answer should be, and you don't want the machine taking guesses on top of your guesses too, right? That would be just a big mess, but you're not going to guess on any of my questions, I'm sure. All right, so get the ES form. That's the best one. All right, so last time we were talking about membrane transport, and remember that you can break transport down into two main categories. What are the two main categories? Active versus passive, right? Active versus passive, and passive means what? Happens automatically. Why? Because something will move down their concentration gradient from high concentration to low, not requiring any energy in terms of extra kinds of molecules. But molecules still can go from low concentration to high, but what's necessary if that happens? You have to have some kind of energy added to the system to make that happen. Right? So we talked about that perfume bottle. Right, and this high concentration of perfume in the bottle, if you open it up, it evaporates and moves from low to high. Right, and some people think, well, you know, the opposite process doesn't happen. Right, the active process doesn't happen going from low to high, like low concentration of perfume in the room into the bottle. But I would have to give you another, submit a question to you is, well, how did all that perfume get in the bottle to begin with? Right, I mean, it didn't happen when the universe was created. Somewhere there was a low concentration of perfume and somebody grabbed all those molecules and stuck it in the bottle. What does that require? Energy for that to happen. So the reverse process is possible, you just need some kind of energy to make it happen. All right, so we talked about simple diffusion without membranes, and we talked about diffusion with membranes, and if it's a water molecule that's moving across a membrane that's selectively permeable by a process of diffusion, what do we call it? Then that is osmosis, right? And then it has to be osmosis, right? Then we started talking about carrier-mediated transport, okay? And then we looked at some important concepts for carrier-mediated transport. Let me get my arrow. It disappeared. Where did it go? Here it is. Okay, I'll make sure it doesn't disappear again. Okay, and these three concepts are specificity, which means that if a substrate or a ligand is just a little molecule that's going to bind to a protein that's in the membrane. If a ligand is going to bind to a transporter that's in the membrane, it has to have the right shape. And remember, small changes in shape mean what? Typically big changes in how things react, right? So most chemical reactions are highly specific, including membrane transport. But if you have two molecules that are very similar, maybe a couple of sugar molecules, maybe they both have to be six carbon sugars. Does anybody know the name of some six carbon sugars? Glucose, and which is another one that's in your book that's very similar. Like lactose is very, very similar, so they're going to have almost the same kind of shape, right? There's going to be competition at a membrane transporter for those two kinds of molecules. Some transporters will be highly specific and can actually select out glucose over galactose, right? But if there is a transporter that is not as specific, then both of these molecules can occupy the transporter. And if there is galactose in the transporter, can glucose get in there? No, so they'll compete for that same transporter, which means then the rate of transport, right, the transport maximum is going to be decreased if two molecules can't compete for the same transporter, which we see right here. And then, of course, right, if all the transporters are occupied with, for instance, glucose, let's just stick with one molecule, glucose, then there's no availability for other glucose molecules to get across the membrane. We call that saturation. So the rate of a reaction, all right, can't increase past that transport maximum point. All right, so kind of be familiar with this graph. And when you start reading graphs, what do you want to do first? Look at the axes first. That will give you a nice orientation. All right, so instead of just looking at all these complicated lines, just look and concentrate on what variable is plotted against another one right here. That's always the best way to look at graphs. All right, so we're still talking about diffusion, which is a passive process, does not require ATP. But some molecules, for instance, still can't get through the membrane because they're polar compounds. And remember the phospholipid bilayer, there's this big nonpolar region that excludes polar molecules. So, for instance, we have, let's just say that this is glucose on the outside. Is that written on this slide? No, that's fine. We'll just say this, oh yeah, glucose right here. All right, what kind of molecule is glucose? Is it polar or nonpolar? And you should probably know why. It's polar because it has a lot of oxygen atoms that are bound to a hydrogen, right? A lot of hydroxyl groups. That makes it a very polar molecule. So does it like to dissolve in water or not? Yeah, because water is a polar substance, right? And that means that glucose can't get through the cell membrane because it can't get through this little lipid region on the interior part of the membrane. So we have high glucose outside the cell, low glucose inside. Does glucose want to get inside the cell by diffusion? Yeah, it is dying to get in there, right? Look at this huge concentration outside the cell, very low inside the cell. Wants to go in, but it can't. So what the cell does is put this little transporter, it's a protein. So now instead of just the phospholipid bilayer, you want to think of the fluid mosaic model of a membrane. And this protein kind of acts like a teeter-totter. And it's open to the one side of the membrane or the other, not both at the same time. So it can be open to the outside of the cell or the inside of the cell, but not both at the same time. When glucose, well, there's low concentration of glucose inside the transporter, so it's going to diffuse in. And it just so happens that there's a nice binding site. All right, so what's the shape of this glucose molecule compared to the binding site? It's nice and complementary. It's like a lock and key or hand and glove. If the shape of this binding site is different than the shape of the molecule that's being transported, then of course, here's a sign-in sheet. I do have one today. Here's a really good one. Okay, so we got to do a redo on the first row. Oh, sorry, over here. So this is a good one. And the reason why I want this one right here, because that's the most recent registration list. So if you're not on this sheet, then you got to talk to me and somebody in administration if it's not too late for that to happen already. Okay. Okay, so what term describes the relationship of this, the shape of the substrate molecule or ligand and the shape of this active site right here. That is what we call what? Specificity, right? So this transporter is highly specific to the shape of this molecule. And when it binds to this protein right here, that would be like you sitting there listening to a lecture, nice and comfortable, having a good time, and then your friend that's sitting next to you take their index finger and poke you in the side. What are you going to do if somebody pokes you in the side right now? Oh, well, you're going to move. You're going to change conformation. You know, hopefully you did not give him a bloody nose or black eye. Okay? Is it the wrong one? Oh, it's 2:31. Well, did we destroy the sign-in sheet that was being passed around? Please pass that one around. Continue with that one. I have the other one, I guess, on my desk. All right, so somebody pokes you in the side. What are you going to do? You're going to change conformation, right? When the glucose molecule binds to this protein, it's like poking the protein in the side, right? And it's going to change conformation. Instead of being open to the extracellular space, now it's open to the intracellular space. And then glucose, of course, is going to diffuse down the concentration gradient into the cell right here, right? So this is what we call facilitated diffusion. It is still passive. Things can still only go from high to low, but it requires this protein transporter inside the cell. And this can be a pretty complicated molecule. It might take a while to build. It might take 6 hours, right? If you have all the, what are the building blocks of this protein right here? Amino acids, the cell has to have all amino acids, it's got to get the right instructions, it's got to go through protein synthesis. And I think that we talk about protein synthesis in here. How many stages are there? Okay, well I think of two. Maybe I didn't talk about it yet. There's transcription, translation. Okay, so two steps for protein synthesis. So to make this protein, all right, it takes a little bit of time. So what about if the cell wants to vary this activity rapidly, to turn on the ability to absorb glucose and turn it off quickly? All right, let's consider the other part of this slide right here. Here's an organelle inside the cell. It looks like a vesicle, and we're going to call it an endosome. An endosome is important for routing of various kinds of membrane proteins or membrane components. So here I see the little glucose transporter. Later on we're going to call this a GLUT4. GLUT means glucose transporter. Number 4 works this way. So inside the cell you have these transporters, and can these transporters take glucose from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell if they're bound to this endosome right here? No, because it's inside the cell. But what happens if this thing can hop a ride on a microtubule, bump into the plasma membrane, and then now this phospholipid bilayer is the same as this phospholipid bilayer right here? That vesicle is going to fuse to the membrane. And now, where do we have these transporters? They're in the plasma membrane, and so they can now transport glucose from outside the cell inside the cell, and that can happen very rapidly. You don't need to build all of these proteins. Okay, so here you can see it. So we don't need to initiate protein synthesis, don't need to regulate it, find the energy to make this protein. So these transporters that are in an endosome are like in a reservoir, right? And the other thing is that insertion into the plasma membrane can be very rapid. And we'll look at this schema a number of times later on. So an endosome is just a vesicle for storing these various membrane components, but if they're inserted into the plasma membrane, that changes the physiology of the cell tremendously, right? And it can be done very rapidly. And then at another time, these transporters right here, right, by a process similar to endocytosis, right, the membrane can fold back on itself and that endosome can be reinstalled into the cytoplasm. So now you have these active transporters inside the cell, not on the plasma membrane, shutting off the ability of that cell to take up glucose. So that's really nice and fast. And that's facilitated diffusion, just a special case of diffusion. All right, so let's change our attention to active transport. All right, so again, active transport means molecules are moving which way? From low to high, running up the hill, low concentration to high concentration. It requires energy for that to happen. What's your favorite energy molecule? You can say Snickers, but in here I want you to say what? ATP. Okay? So ATP is the universal energy currency for almost all reactions in your body. Not quite all, but most. All right, so let's look at the slide over here. Here we have a membrane, nice phospholipid bilayer, and it's separating the cytoplasm from the extracellular fluid. And let's just say that we have calcium at a high concentration outside the cell. If you want to memorize that, that would be great, because I want you to know calcium is going to be high outside the cell. And if it's a living cell, it's going to be low on the inside. We want it to be low under most circumstances. So how does a cell make sure that it's low on the inside and high on the outside? If a cell wants calcium to be low on the inside, it just kicks calcium out of the cell. But how does calcium have to go from low to high? Is that going to happen automatically? No, it's going to require energy, active transport, and in this particular case, it's going to be ATP. All right, so calcium can move into the transporter, and it's got to bump into a binding site. It has to bind to the transporter. All right, but it doesn't bind with enough force to cause a conformation change right here. There's something else that causes the conformation change, and that is this ATP. ATP binds to the protein at a different site compared to the site where calcium bound to it. Okay, and when it does, there is an ATPase on this protein. What is an ATPase? Whenever you hear a term with an ASC on the end of it, that's just nomenclature. It means it's an enzyme. It means that it performs an active kind of function. It can change molecules around, rearrange molecules, right? And it rearranges this ATP, splits it off, splits it into two molecules, ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right, and what you learn in lab this week is that some chemical reactions release energy, some chemical reactions require energy to take place. Okay, so this protein conformation change requires energy. You think of it just as a chemical reaction. Where does it get energy from? Because when ATP is hydrolyzed, and you know what that term means, hydrolyzed is what, when you break something apart using a water molecule, it releases energy, enough energy to cause the conformation change in this protein. So now calcium is on the outside of the cell in a high area of concentration, and where was it before? At a low concentration. So this is active transport. As a matter of fact, maybe in your notes you should just write down primary active transport, or a number one with a degree sign by it, meaning that it's primary active transport. And if you ever see an active transport mechanism that requires ATP, or with ATP drawn on that slide, you know it's primary. That also gives you a little foreshadowing in the class, right? If we bother to label this primary active transport, what does that mean? Well, there's probably going to be some other kind of process, right, that we're going to call secondary active transport. All right, but primary requires ATP. All right, here is the phospholipid bilayer, and here is a protein, and this protein is probably using up more energy in your body than any other process that's going on inside your body. And is this an example of primary active transport? And how are you going to see that right away? It's not on this slide, but do you see ATP in the diagram? Is it being hydrolyzed? Primary active transport. So this process is unfavorable, won't happen by itself. So it's active transport, and in particular, primary active transport. And we can see potassium. That's, you all know that K stands for potassium? Oh, good, right? All right, so potassium is going from, and you see it not in a bold type right here, that means that it's going from low concentration to high concentration inside the cell. All right, so that's active transport, right? When something goes from low to high. What about sodium right here? Na, you know, is sodium. It's going from low concentration to high concentration outside the cell. What does that require? No energy or some energy? Energy, right? Okay, so it's active transport. So both sodium and potassium require energy to move across the cell membrane. The other point of this slide that's really nice is that, just make a nice photocopy in your mind of this slide, right? Because it tells you in a normal living cell where you have relatively high potassium. Is it inside the cell or outside? Potassium is relatively high inside, and where is sodium relatively high? On the outside. All right, and notice, what are these chemical compounds right here? They are electrolytes, right? They're ions because they have electrical charge on them. Okay, and furthermore, this is primary active transport because this molecule right here, this protein, requires ATP to be used up, right? ATP has to be split into ADP and inorganic phosphate, right, in order for these ions to move across the membrane. Okay, furthermore, so this is what we call a pump, right? So just like a pump you'd use when you're out camping, there's water underground, but you want to drink it, what do you have to do? you have to expend some energy to get that pump working, to get the water going from low to high so that you can drink it. So these kinds of proteins in the cell membrane that move ions from low concentration to high are what we call pumps. And this is the typical sodium potassium ATP pump. It moves sodium and potassium against their gradients. One last important thing about this slide right here, notice since these are ions, right? Usually your cell likes to have things electrically neutral. But guess what happens when you move, right? And look at this, okay? How many, when this pump is working, does it move an equal number of potassiums and sodiums across the membrane? An unequal number, right? So two potassiums move in while three sodiums move out. And there's some really good interactive exercises in Blackboard that actually show you how these molecules are moving. You got to look at those videos, right? Answer some of the questions on those videos in Blackboard to help you solidify your understanding of this thing. But you know what? If we move two potassiums in and three sodiums out, guess what happens to the electrical properties of this cell? It changes because there's an unequal number of charges that are moving. So if we only pump in two positive charges but pump out three, what happens to the inside of the cell? It becomes a little negative when that happens, right? So these pumps are loaded in all living cells, so all of your cells are separating electrical charge out and become batteries, right? A battery is just a device that has a negative charge on one side and a positive charge on the other. Like a battery has how many terminals? It's got two terminals. One is positive, the other is negative, right? So you could think of every cell in your body as being a battery because of this sodium-potassium pump, and that electrical energy is used to perform a lot of physiologic functions that we're going to look at a little bit later in the class. All right, so that's primary active transport. Secondary active transport is, like it says, it's still active transport. So which way are things moving? High to low or low to high? Low to high if it's active transport, but if it's secondary active transport, it doesn't directly require ATP. It requires another form of energy energy in some other kind of form. And that other form of energy is a concentration gradient of some kind of chemical, right? So we looked at this slide over here, and we just said that now we got an electrical gradient. It's negative on the inside, positive on the outside. Right, that's a form of energy, right? That's why you have batteries. What do batteries do? They provide energy for various devices that you have, your cell phone or computer. So every cell has that available energy source because there's a gradient of charge, negative on the inside, positive on the outside. Let's think of other kinds of gradients. Okay. Secondary active transport. Okay. First off, you need to have some kind of pump that is going to take a molecule from low concentration to high. All right, so what kind of transport goes from low to high? Active, okay. And in this particular case, we're going to talk about the sodium-potassium pump, right? And we say it's primary active transport. This slide I modified. It's not exactly in your book, but you should modify it yourself on the PowerPoint slides even more than I've modified it by including this little statement right here. All right, so we have sodium going from low concentration to high, okay, and so that requires energy. On that previous slide, where does that energy come from? And you see it right here, ATP. So if you have a process that's active requiring ATP, what kind of active transport is that? That's primary active transport. So draw in like a big ATP. It's right here, all right, but draw it in even bigger. So it's a nice big sign for your eye to see. So now we have sodium at a high concentration, and guess what it really loves to do? It loves to go back down to low concentration, right? Just by passive diffusion, it automatically will go back down to a lower concentration right here. But the cell membranes are pretty fancy, okay? It can take that concentration gradient of sodium that's run up this hill, all right, and then allow it to go back down across the membrane, and when it falls back down through the membrane, right, that energy of falling through the membrane right here because of this protein that's in the membrane can cause glucose to go from what concentration? From low all the way up to high concentration. All right, so going from low to high is what? Active or passive? It's active, okay, but do you see any ATP over here? Do you see any ATP making glucose go from low to high? Nope. So can it be primary active transport? Can't be primary because there's no ATP. So if it's not primary active transport, what do we call that? Secondary active transport. All right, it still requires energy, but where does that energy come from if it's not ATP? It is that sodium running down its concentration gradient. It can be coupled with this protein that's in the membrane. All right, so now you know two important forms of active transport. One is primary, which requires absolutely what molecule? ATP. If it's not on the diagram, then it's not primary active transport. All right, but if it's going from low concentration to high, still requires energy. But if it's not ATP, it's what we call secondary active transport. It's going to rely on the gradient from some other kind of molecule. Okay. Let's consider talking about secondary active transport. So if we look at all these diagrams right here, do you see any ATP in any of these things? No ATP. But we have glucose, okay, and so we have glucose and sodium. We have sodium on the outside of the cell that's at a really high concentration, low on the inside of the cell, so does sodium want to get inside the cell? Can it go in passively, high to low? Yeah, right, so that is what, an energy source, that concentration gradient. It can maybe drag some other molecules along with it. Here's an example of glucose, how it gets dragged along inside the cell. Okay, so here is glucose, which is low on the outside of the cell, it's low on the outside but high on the inside. How does this glucose get in? It's using the energy in the sodium gradient, right? So both of these molecules have to bind to the protein transporter. When they both bind, what is that like? It's like poking you in the side, conformation change. Now the protein is open to the inside of the cell. Both glucose and sodium enter the cell. All right, so glucose moves up its concentration gradient when that happens, but what happens to sodium? It moves down its concentration gradient. Moving down the concentration gradient is the energy source for moving glucose. So that's why we call it secondary active transport, because there's no ATP required. All right, so there are two kinds of secondary active transport. There's co-transport and counter-transport. In this example that we looked at, what are the two molecules that are moving across the membrane? Sodium and glucose. And did they both go the same direction, or did one go one way and the other molecule go the other? They both went the same way, right? If they go the same way, we call that a symport, secondary active transport, or co-transport mechanism. If you have two molecules, they move in opposite directions, okay? Then we call that counter-transport or anti-transport. All right, but this example here clearly is what? A symport or co-transport. Both molecules are going in the same direction. All right, so here's a pretty cool slide that shows a really important process. And we've spent a lot of time on this one already. And a very important energy molecule in your body is glucose. So here we have glucose in the lumen of a kidney tubule. And you're going to have to maybe review your anatomy a little bit. But if you have substances in the lumen of a kidney tubule, where does it end up eventually? Well, yeah, you pee it out of your body, right? It's excreted as urine. But glucose is a very important energy molecule. You don't want to excrete it. Your body wants to maintain energy molecules because you need that energy to stay alive. So if glucose stays in the blood and it's lost in the urine, that would be like going to the gas station and paying $5 a gallon for gas and then taking an ice pick, going to your gas tank and putting a hole in it, right, and have it run out of the gas tank. Big waste of money. All right, so your body doesn't do that under normal circumstances. It does what? It takes glucose from the kidney tubule and puts it back into the blood. All right, so how does that happen? What can you tell me about glucose? Can it get through this membrane right here? No, because glucose is polar, right, and only nonpolar compounds can move across the membrane. There's also sodium in this kidney tubule right here, and sodium is at a high concentration inside the kidney tubule. And where is sodium always going to be low concentration? Low inside the cell. Because of what? The sodium-potassium pump right here. All right. So sodium is going to be low inside the cell. Does sodium want to move from the kidney tubule inside the cell? From high concentration to low? Passive process? Sure, it wants to rush in. But what else can you tell me about that concentration of gradient of sodium right here? not only does sodium want to rush in, but in your mind, what should you think of that? That's like an entity. That's like a, that's a physical thing. That is energy, right? When you have a gradient of something, that is energy. So here is some energy, and that energy can be used to move glucose from low concentration to high concentration, right? Because can something move from low to high passively? No, it requires energy. Where is it getting the energy from? The sodium gradient right here. Now, that's active transport, but what kind of active transport is that? It's secondary active transport. Furthermore, you could classify it in your mind right now. Is it an antiport or symport? Or is it countertransport or co-transport? Okay, this is co-transport because both sodium and glucose are going in the same direction, right? So that energy of sodium gradient is used to bring glucose inside the cell, all right? But now, what do we have with the sodium? It's never really high inside the cell because there are pumps, sodium-potassium pumps, and here's that sodium-potassium pump. It's pumping sodium out into the blood. That also means that potassium is coming in. But this right here, the sodium-potassium pump, is what kind of active transport? Is it primary or secondary? Well, how do you know it's primary? I don't see it. Where is it? Oh, yeah, there it is, ATP, right? So it's primary active transport. All right, one last thing, one last little detail on this slide right here. We have glucose at a high concentration inside the cell, all right, but we want it in the blood. What's the concentration in the blood? It's low. Does glucose want to go into the blood from inside the cell? Passively? Absolutely. But can it? No, can't get through the membrane, so what do we need? A little protein carrier right here that allows some kind of pathway, which is on the previous slide, to allow that polar compound, namely glucose, to go across the membrane. So here is what passive, this is just diffusion, but a special kind of diffusion, facilitated diffusion. Yeah?
Which is actually happening first?
It all happens at the same time. But none of it can happen unless there's this ATP right here to run this pump. And more energy in your body is used to run these sodium-potassium pumps everywhere all over your body than anywhere else. Even if you're a marathon runner, right, still. ATP is used just to keep these pumps working, to keep these gradients of sodium and potassium across the membrane just the way they should be so that everything else can happen. I think I talked about how much ATP. How much ATP do you need every day in your body? Maybe I didn't talk about it in here. A typical textbook person is 70 kilograms. We're all probably a little bit more than 70 kilograms in here, but that's a typical textbook figure. What if we average everybody together? We'd be pretty close. All right, and then if we were to measure how many of these ATP molecules are required, it would be 40 kilograms. So more than half your body weight is burned up, okay, every day, is broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And so that you need a huge amount of ATP, right? And ATP is made from ADP and inorganic phosphate where? In mitochondria. That's the job of mitochondria, is to make all of that ATP. You don't need a suitcase full of 40 kilograms of ATP because mitochondria can make it for you as soon as you use it up, as soon as you burn it up, yeah.
70 or 40?
You need 40 kilograms. A typical person is 70 kilograms. All right, and you need about 40 kilograms of ATP a day to stay alive, which is more than half your body weight. Fortunately, you don't have to have like a suitcase full. You don't have to be eating ATP all day long. All right, mitochondria can do that. We have to be eating other things like milkshakes and things like that. Okay. All right, so this is a really important slide because it goes over what? Primary active transport, secondary active transport. Plus then you should know the difference between co-transport and antiport. The other things on this slide are just little complexities. Like, for instance, we wouldn't have to worry about things diffusing across the wall of this tubule right here, right, if there was a passageway between the cells. And there's no passageway between these cells because there are junctional complexes that, what, glue these cells together, like desmosomes, tight junctions, and things like that. So molecules can't pass between the cells. They actually have to do what? Go through the cell. And then again, remember that what about the apical membrane right here compared to the basolateral membrane? Do they look identical? Well, I see microvilli on this one, and it's just flat on this side. That's sort of interesting. But the other thing, even at a molecular level, the transporters are different, right? So these cells are a lot different depending on whether you're talking about the apical membrane or the basolateral cell membrane right here. So the cell is really busy figuring out where to put all these proteins all the time and which ones you need. Here's another form of active transport. We call this bulk transport. So things, some molecules that can't dissolve, maybe they're way too big, or maybe cell fragments, right? If a cell wants to ingest them, right, here are just some big molecules, can't get through the cell membrane, but it can bump up against the membrane, and then the membrane can invaginate to form a little dimple, and it can further, right, invaginate, and then the cell kind of pinches off, or this little dimple pinches off from the rest of the cell membrane, forming a vesicle, and it breaks away from the cell wall. So now these particles end up inside the cell, inside this vesicle. That is endocytosis, right? And endocytosis has two forms. If these are just, if this is a solution, then we would call it pinocytosis, because that is cell drinking. If these are really solid particles or precipitates, then we call that phagocytosis, or cell eating. And, of course, it takes ATP to move this membrane around and to move this vesicle around inside the cell when it hops a ride on a microtubule, right? So this is primary active transport. The same thing for the reverse, right? If there are compounds, like maybe mucus, that end up in this vesicle, when the vesicle moves over to the cell membrane, it fuses, and now the interior contents of the vesicle are released to the outside of the cell. So that is exocytosis, like, as a part, the end stage of the secretory pathway for proteins or other kinds of modified proteins that a cell needs to secrete. All right, so is bulk transport passive or active? This kind of stuff just doesn't happen automatically, okay? Fusion of these membranes can happen automatically, okay, because that's their general nature to do that, but moving these membranes around and the vesicle around, that requires ATP for that to happen. Okay, next topic, membrane potential. Whenever you see this potential, that just means voltage. And potential means like the ability to make something happen. So if there's a voltage, then there's an electrical ability to make something happen. There's an electrical energy available. All right, and this electrical energy or electrical potential is associated with the cell membrane. Right, and if that cell membrane has a voltage across it, it just allows that membrane to do some kind of work. So in lab, you start talking about thermodynamics, I think, this week, or maybe even a little bit last week, talk about free energy changes, but I'm not sure anybody talked about what the heck energy is. And energy is kind of an abstract term, but it's a very real term, even though it's abstract. All right, so it's not like an eraser that we can measure by its weight or its dimensions. All right, but we measure, a good way to think about energy is that it's the ability to do work, right? So if you have energy in your body, what can your body do? A lot of work. If you have energy, you feel like doing a lot of work. But if you have no energy, what kind of work do you do? Very, very little, right? So potential is energy, which means that this membrane has the ability to do some kind of work for you, beneficial work. All right, so membrane potential and membrane voltage are really the same thing. All right, so what devices do you own that contain a voltage? Like any kind of battery. Yeah, any kind of battery has a voltage. And what devices do you have? Another way of asking this is, what devices do you have a battery? I probably have like two or three. Oh, geez, I have four things that have batteries. I got my watch that has a battery. I've got this microphone that has a battery, I've got this microphone that has a battery, and then I have a cell phone that has a battery. So these devices can be doing work for me, all right? You guys probably have four or five batteries on you too, okay? And how many terminals does a battery have? Just two. It's got a plus and a minus, which means there's what? A concentration gradient of electrical charge across the terminals that can be used to do work for you. All right, so here we have a cell, just a typical kind of cell. And let's talk about the membrane voltage right here. Inside the cell, there are big proteins that can never get across the cell membrane. And all these proteins have a nice negative charge on them. So the inside of the cell has a tendency to be really negative because all these proteins can't get on the outside. All right, so that makes a nice negative charge right here. All right, so what does that mean in terms of attraction or repulsion? What do these negative charges, how do they interact with positive charges? Do they attract each other or repel?
Attract.
Opposite charges always attract. So these fixed anions are going to attract positive charges to the inside of the cell. All right, let me read what I have right here. Okay, membrane potential is a difference of charge across the membrane. All right, so why is that? Because these fixed ions are trapped, right, which means the inside of the cell is going to be a little bit negative. That's going to attract cations. What's a cation? A positive charge. It's going to attract cations to the inside of the cell. So let's just say that these are sodium ions. No, let's say potassium ions, because potassiums are cations. So potassium is going to diffuse inside the cell. All right, so if potassium moves inside the cell, what happens to potassium concentration on the outside? It goes down. All right, so here we have now two forces that's making potassium move around. You have the electrical charge, which is bringing potassium inside the cell, right, to neutralize the negative charge on the proteins that are in there. But when potassium becomes a high concentration inside the cell and low outside the cell, guess what it likes to do? It likes to move back out. Okay, but it moves back out, but what's dragging it back in? The negative charges. All right, so if there were no negative charges inside the cell and we let this sit overnight, what would be the electrical charge across the membrane without these fixed anions? They would be exactly equal, right? Because things would just, if potassium moves just by diffusion, you'd have the same concentration here and on the inside and outside, which means you would have what? The same electrical charge on the outside, the same electrical charge on the inside. Everything would balance out very nicely. But now let's put these proteins inside the cell and wait overnight. What's going to happen? These negative charges will pull more positive charges inside the cell so that when we get up in the morning, okay, we're going to have fewer of these potassiums outside the cell, okay, and more inside because these negative charges are pulling them in. Okay. The other thing is that sodium is not permeable. It's kicked out of the cell by that ATP pump. What charge does a sodium have? It's a positive charge, right? It's a positive charge. All right, so these fixed ions draw potassium in. The sodium ATP pump pumps sodium out. Okay, and as a matter of fact, how many sodiums for every potassium? 3 to 2. Okay, 3 to 2. All right, so as a result of that, right, there are two forces that we're going to be interested in looking at. The electrical attraction of potassium is pulling it in, okay, but the fusion is forcing it out, so these things have to balance out, and when that happens, the inside of the cell becomes negative with respect to the outside because there isn't enough potassium to neutralize all of these fixed anions right here. All right, why can't potassium just move into the cell to neutralize all these negative charges on the protein? Because when potassium builds up inside the cell, now you have a concentration gradient that forces it out. So there's always going to be a little leftover negative charge inside the cell when that happens. All right, and so that develops a membrane potential across the cell. So when we come back in the morning, there's a new equilibrium that's established. All right, and it's going to be the balance between diffusion, which is forcing potassium out, and the electrical attraction that is doing what? Forcing potassium in. So there's a new equilibrium. We call that the equilibrium potential for potassium. Right? And that's because these anions right here can't leave the cell. We also call that something else. What is it when something can't, what kind of particles are these when they can't leave the cell? They are osmotically active, right? When we were talking about osmotic pressure. All right, and it just so happens that if we take a voltmeter, we can measure that electrical property of the membrane. And a voltmeter, you would put across the terminals of a battery to measure the voltage. So how many electrodes does a voltmeter have? It's got two, because every battery has two terminals, and then you can measure the voltage on a battery. Okay, so the same thing. So here's just a nice voltmeter. You stick one lead inside the cell, the other on the outside of the cell, and you can measure what that voltage is, and in most cells, it's about minus 90 millivolts, or 0.09 volts. That's a small voltage, but it's really easy to measure, all right? So if this cell has minus 90 millivolts across the membrane, negative on the outside, positive on the inside, think in terms of a battery. Is that a good battery or a bad battery? That's a good battery. Okay, that's what it should be. But what happens if you do this to a cell and you don't measure a voltage across the plasma membrane right here? Take a battery out of your cell phone, measure it with a voltmeter, and you see it reading 0 volts. What does that mean? We call that a dead battery, right? If we do that to a cell and measure 0 volts right here, what kind of cell is that? That's a dead cell, okay? Basically, it means it's run out of ATP. Those sodium-potassium pumps stop working, and that's not a good thing. So every cell to be alive has to have that voltage across it, just like batteries that you have. All right, so here is an equation that you should know for how to work on the exam. It's very similar to a pH equation, where you have to use the log button on your calculators to do that. So remember, no sharing of calculators on the test, because if you use a calculator that you're not familiar with, you might not know how to enter the numbers properly, even though you know the equation and that kind of thing, because all calculators work just a little bit differently. Plus, I don't want you to share things on a test either. Okay, the Nernst equation can compute this equilibrium potential for a particular ion just by knowing the concentration gradient. All right, so it gives the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on an ion. All right, oops, I wanted to go backwards. So the Nernst equation tells us this voltage where there is an exact balance between the electrical attraction that's pulling potassium in and the concentration gradient that's forcing it out. Will tell us that exact equilibrium point, right? And the value depends on the ratio of ionic concentrations inside and outside the cell. So here is the equilibrium potential. E stands for the equilibrium potential, and it's equal to 61 divided by Z. Z is the charge on a particle. What's the charge on a potassium particle? It's 1. So that's really easy. What's the charge on a sodium ion? It's 1, right? But it also has magnitude, so you would want to put in this equation right here, plus 1. There are some ions that have a negative charge, some are anions, right? So then you would put what? A negative 1 right here, like for instance for a chlorine atom. Some ions have a plus 2 charge, like magnesium, and so you put a plus 2 right here. That's not too complicated, right? And 61 is just the constant for converting different kinds of numbers so that they make sense. And then here you put the concentration of the ion outside the cell, right? And you don't have to put positive or negative right here. It's just the concentration. Where did you take care of whether it's an anion or cation? That's taken care of with the Z right here, right? So there's no such thing as a negative concentration of something. It's just whatever the concentration is outside the cell and the concentration of that ion that is inside the cell. That X could be a number of things, like sodium, right, or potassium, magnesium, chloride. And then when you put these concentrations in, you can calculate the equilibrium potential. All right, so that Z is just the valence, right, it's just the overall charge on that ion, whether it's 1 or minus 1 or whatever. So here's a pretty important slide for you to know something about. Here's that Nernst equation. Here's a nice cell. And I've got 4 important ions for you to look at. We've got sodium, and we got, what do we have here? Potassium, and then we've got chloride, and then we've got calcium, okay? And it tells you, and I don't want you to memorize these numbers right here. So if I ever ask you to calculate something, I will give you these numbers. But what I think is important for this figure is to know, in the normal cell, where is sodium at high concentration? You're going to say, because you've memorized this picture to some degree, it's high where? In a normal cell, outside. What about for potassium? Where's potassium normally high? Inside the cell. What about chloride? Oh, there's hardly any inside the cell, but there's a lot higher outside. And what about calcium? Oh, there's a huge concentration gradient for calcium, right? There's hardly any inside the cell, and it's high outside. So I want you to know the relative distance or concentrations of these 4 important ions. All right, so know which ions are high inside and which are high outside, but I don't care that you know the numbers, okay, for the calculation. I could give that to you. All right, so calculate the equilibrium potential for potassium. What would we do? Do we have enough data to know that? Well, in your mind, we know what the valence state is of potassium. What is it? Well, it tells you right here. It's plus 1. So we put a plus 1 right here. So what do we multiply this whole number by, the log of these concentrations? We multiply it by Just the 61, right? Okay, that would be easy to do. And what about the concentration of potassium? Do we know what it is outside and inside the cell? Yeah, because it tells you right here. Where does it tell? Oh, right here. So inside the cell, it's 150. You want to put that in the denominator, and it's 5 millimolar on the outside. We put that in the numerator. We divide those two numbers together first, and then take the log of it, multiply it by 61, and we get the correct answer. All right, so that's pretty easy to do. So if we do that, okay, if we do that, these are roughly the numbers that we get, about minus 90 for potassium, and roughly 60. It might be a little bit different than that for sodium. If anybody has their calculator handy, you can check and see if this slide is right. I have a vague recollection that one of these numbers is off, maybe by 2 or 3 millivolts. Okay, but you can check that. But nonetheless, you could check, all right, you could tell me the equilibrium voltage that develops across the membrane for each of these. Like for calcium, how would we have to modify this calculation for potassium? Of course, by the concentration gradients, but what else? This Z changes. What does this Z change to? Plus 2. If we did it for chloride, how would Z change? It would be a minus 1, which means that the voltage switches from inside to outside when that happens. Instead of being minus 90, it would be a plus 90.
If you
want to do a negative minus 2.8, 90? Okay, 93 instead of 90 for this one right here. All right, so there are probably some round-off errors in this slide right here. Okay, so if you don't calculate it exactly, that's probably okay. On a test, you know, if you get close, you'll know what the right answer is. Okay, so a cell at rest has these concentrations of ions across the membrane that could be due to a number of different things, like maybe that pump, for instance, we were talking about. So at rest, right, there is a voltage across the cell, and we call that the resting membrane potential, when a cell is not doing anything in particular, when it's just at rest. Like some of the cells in your body are at rest right now. Other cells in your body are really active trying to figure all this out, right, using up energy. So RMP is resting membrane potential. Right? For instance, when a muscle is not contracting, it's going to be at rest. So that range is about minus 65 to minus 85. But what is it always on the inside of the cell? It's always going to be negative with respect to the outside. Then there's a little bit of a range, but that's okay. All right, the RMP depends on the concentrations of ions inside and outside the cell, like what you've just been calculating with your calculator, but also on some other things, like the permeability of ions through the membrane. Sometimes ions can get through the membrane, sometimes it can't, right? And when the permeability changes, then the voltage across the membrane is going to change. And that voltage can be used to control physiology of the cell, right? And mostly it's due to changes in potassium, because potassium is the most permeable. So if the permeability of the membrane changes to a particular ion, that means it's going to have a large effect on the voltage across the membrane. All right, so small changes in permeability can cause big changes in sodium. All right, so some sodium diffuses inside the cell. So when we calculate the resting membrane potential using the Nernst equation, it changes a little bit because some sodium can leak in. Right, and some potassium can leak out that changes the voltage across the cell. So the resting membrane potential is less than, right, the equilibrium potential that we can calculate. All right. The other thing that changes that makes the calculation a little bit different is that, don't forget, we have that sodium-potassium pump. We say it's electrogenic because it doesn't pump equal amounts of sodium and potassium across the cell membrane. Right, so if it pumps less potassium into the cell while pumping more sodium out, then the inside of the cell becomes what? A little negative compared to the outside. So that's another thing besides what? Those fixed anions inside the cell and the permeability across the membrane. So all of these things kind of add up so that in a normal cell, right, we end up with about minus 70 millivolts, which is what? A little bit different than that minus 90 that we calculated. And so what is this voltage due to? Those fixed anions inside the cell, which are negative. Different permeabilities of the membrane to sodium and potassium. That sodium-potassium pump that pumps unequal numbers, right? And then just due to the Nernst equation, the difference in voltage produced by concentration gradients of these different ions. But don't forget, this is just sodium and potassium. There's also, what two other important ions are there? Chloride and calcium, which then contribute to the resting membrane potential. So if we just add all those things up together, which can't be done not in a nice algebraic way with any equation that I showed you so far, you end up with a living cell of about minus 70 millivolts, okay, if it's a nice living cell at rest. Okay, and then the cell can do that to signal various things at the cell membrane. All right, so let's talk about cell signaling. All right, so how do cells communicate with each other? They communicate with each other through something that's called a synapse. And I make a little distinction on this slide compared to what your book does, right? So the structural and functional unit of communication between cells is called a synapse. If two cells are going to communicate with each other, they need a synapse. And there's two main kinds of synapses all over in your body. There's one that's called electrical. An electrical synapse means that one cell can share an electrical event with another. All right, so for instance, if a sodium ion moves inside the cell, one cell, what happens to that resting membrane potential? Where is it normally negative? Inside the cell is normally negative, and if sodium runs in, what happens to the inside of the cell? Becomes less negative, a little bit more positive. That could be a signaling event. So if a cell does that, it can share that information if there is an electrical synapse. It can share that rush of sodium inside the cell with a neighboring cell, thereby changing what? The electrical properties of the neighboring cell when that happens. We have very few of those kinds of synapses, but nonetheless, we call that an electrical synapse. Right? Another kind of synapse is called a chemical synapse, and that means that information travels from one cell to the other, not as an electrical signal, not as sodium maybe moving from one cell to the other, but some kind of chemical messenger. Right, so, and we're gonna look at that. Some examples of chemical messengers might be neurotransmitters. A neurotransmitter is secreted by one neuron, and then it diffuses over to another neuron, and it causes some change in the second neuron. That would be a chemical synapse. But we need to analyze these different kinds of synapses. So, for instance, what's a nice familiar thing that you're looking at right now? A little breath of fresh air. You see what? Oh, a nice phospholipid bilayer right here, right? Nice cell membrane. So I see a cell on the top, cytoplasm in there. I see cytoplasm down on the bottom. But these two cells are not isolated from each other. What do they have? They have these little proteins that actually form a nice tunnel between them. And these tunnels are big enough to let a sodium ion move from one cell to the other. And these are what we call gap junctions, right? So if sodium enters the top cell, right. Well, let's just say at the beginning, the concentration of sodium inside the cytoplasm of the top cell and the bottom cell right here is exactly the same. So does sodium want to move one way or the other? No, right? Because it has an equal concentration. But let's just say, for whatever reason, this top cell has a bunch of sodium rushing inside of it. So now we have a higher concentration of sodium here and a low concentration of sodium in the second cell. So what does sodium want to do? It wants to move down the concentration gradient, doesn't require any energy to do that, okay? And when it does, what happens to the electrical property of the second cell? The inside of the cell, which was before very negative, becomes what? Less negative or more positive because sodium is coming in. That's a very nice signaling event for this cell that has changed the voltage of this cell right here, which means the physiology of the cell is going to change. That kind of electrical synapse, when that positive charge, right, that's really a positive charge, goes from one cell directly into another. That's what we call an electrical synapse. And what does an electrical, what components do these two cells have to have in order for it to have an electrical synapse between them? It has to have these gap junctions right here, right? If there are gap junctions, then that sodium can't get through these two membranes, right, because it's a polar compound, can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. So they're usually isolated electrically, but if it has a gap junction, they are electrically connected to each other because sodium is an electrolyte. It's an ion, right? The movement of that positive charge from one cell into the other, right, is an electrical current. Electrical current is just an electrical charge that's in motion. That's all there is to it. So these things are connected by those electrical currents. Here's the second kind of synapse. Right, and now we're not concerned with ions at all. we're concerned with just some kind of signaling molecule right here, and we could think of these maybe as neurotransmitters or maybe even endocrine agents like hormones. All right, so a chemical synapse, all right, a second cell that's going to be it's going to respond to some kind of chemical signal, like maybe a neurotransmitter. So here's the cell that is sending out a signal, and it kind of looks turquoise to me. What color is that? Oh, wow, that's not anywhere near turquoise. Okay. These darn computer monitors, right, they're never calibrated. Okay. All right, so here you have a purple cell, and you can see they're separated from these cells down over here that are red, right? Reddish brown, whatever color that is. Who knows? Okay. They're separated from each other, but maybe these cells up here know something, and it wants to share that information with these cells down over here. And let's just say maybe these are muscle cells, for instance, and these are nerve cells trying to tell these muscle cells to contract. There's no electrical synapse. I don't see any gap junction between them. So these cells are going to release something, a signaling molecule. They're going to secrete a signaling molecule into this interstitial space, and then diffusion is going to take it from high concentration to low concentration. These signaling molecules are going to bump into these cells down over here, and it's going to change the physiology of these cells. All right, but there has to be something special on the cell membranes of these red-brown cells down over here to be sensitive to these signaling compounds. All right, so what do these cells need in order to be sensitive to this signaling compound? Yeah, just think of that response loop. Go back to response loop. In order to be sensitive to a stimulus, there has to be a receptor, and there are molecular receptors on the cell membranes of these cells, and again, it's going to be the three criteria that you're concerned with. It's got to have specificity. The shape of these receptors has to be complementary to the shape of these signaling molecules. All right, so here I see a nice circular signaling molecule. What's the shape of the receptor on these target cells? It's got to be, semicircular so that this little molecule can bind to it, so this little ligand can bind to it, and then it's going to change the physiology inside the cell when that happens. So we call these target cells if they have what? They have to have a particular receptor in the cell membrane to be sensitive to the signaling molecules. If they don't have the receptor molecule, then you could have billions of these signaling molecules floating around these cells, and they'll be completely unaware that they're there. Right, so then it can't be a target tissue or a target cell unless it has a receptor. All right, so what must a target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? A receptor, it's got to be complementary in shape because that's how things work. Right, oh, what must be the shape of the binding site on the paracrine receptor right here? Got to be complementary, right? So if the signaling molecule is a hand, the receptor's got to be a, not another hand, it's got to be a glove, right? Complementary in shape. Okay, so this scheme right here is what we call a chemical synapse, not an electrical synapse. Here is a pretty good example of a chemical synapse where there is a neuron that transmits electrical information very quickly, but that electrical information doesn't hop from this neuron into the muscle cell because that would cause like a little lightning bolt to happen right there. That doesn't happen because I see a space between the cells. But the axon releases a chemical that we call a neurotransmitter because it's coming from a neuron. It diffuses to the muscle, and then it binds to a receptor, changing the physiology of the cell. What's the physiology of this cell? How is it going to change when the neurotransmitter binds to it? It's going to shorten. It's going to contract because maybe you can see, oh, yeah, I see striations right there. Right? That's a nice skeletal muscle cell. All right, so read, what does it say right here? What must be the shape of the neurotransmitter and the binding site? All right, you kind of know that already. Here's another scheme, which is kind of just a recapitulation of a slide that I showed you before. Instead of a hormone and a neurotransmitter, here is an endocrine gland. Endocrine gland is what kind of gland? Ductless, right? It has no ducts. Exocrine glands have ducts. So here's a ductless gland. It's secreting something not into a duct, but just into the interstitial space, right? And now we have it at a high concentration in the interstitial space, low concentration in the blood. So what's it going to do? Diffuse into the blood. Where can things diffuse in and out of the circulatory system? Only one kind of structure. Yeah, capillaries. So you should think of, oh, you got arteries, you got veins and capillaries. Arteries and veins, things can't diffuse across the walls of those vessels because why? Way too thick. They got too many layers. They got muscle layers, connective tissue, elastic layers. Capillaries are what? Thin. Right? And some even have pores in them right here. So that hormone, which is the term of that compound, the signaling compound that an endocrine secretes, right? It ends up in the blood, and when it's in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere. Is it going to signal every cell in your body to do something? Only specific ones that have what? A receptor, right? So the hormone goes everywhere, but only certain cells have those receptors, and don't forget that hormone diffuses down its concentration gradient into this interstitial space, and it can signal this cell to do something if it has the receptor, right? So not all cells have receptors for everything. Okay. So how do regulatory molecules influence target cells? Okay, a couple of different ways. If it's a hydrophobic regulatory molecule, so here is the regulatory molecule. If it's hydrophobic, what does that mean? Does it like to dissolve in lipid or dissolve in water? If it's hydrophobic, afraid of water, it likes to dissolve in liquid, in lipid, right? It can pass through, which means it can pass through the cell membrane. Right, so this signaling molecule can actually get inside the cell. It's not trapped outside the cell. It can get through the phospholipid bilayer. And so if it's a hydrophobic regulatory molecule, the receptors are not on the cell membrane. They are inside the cell because they can actually enter the cell. Right, so here is the receptor inside the cell. And these receptors inside the cell go to the nucleus, and they regulate protein synthesis. And when this compound goes into the nucleus, it stimulates messenger RNA synthesis, which is what we call transcription. And then when messenger RNA is in the cytoplasm, then the second step of protein synthesis can take place, namely translation. So this regulatory hormone can make proteins inside the cell, which then change the physiology of this cell, right, if it's a hydrophobic. Some examples of this would be steroids, thyroid hormones, and nitric oxide can enter the cell and change protein synthesis at the nucleus. Right, hydrophilic regulatory molecules. What does this mean? Love water. Can't get through the cell membrane. All right, so if it can't get through the cell membrane, right, can it bind to receptors inside the cell? Nope. There's got to be an extracellular receptor on the surface of the cell membrane. When it binds, then it changes, right, the concentration of another compound inside the cell, which then will change the physiology inside the cell. So if it's a hydrophilic molecule, the first messenger binds to the receptor outside the cell, and it causes the development of some second molecule inside the cell. We call that a second messenger. So some questions would be, where is the first messenger always located? Outside the cell. Where is the second messenger always located? Inside the cell. What do you need for the second messenger to develop inside the cell? You need a receptor and a first messenger outside. Okay, so this first messenger, if it binds to a receptor, right, will cause the second messenger to develop. And that process right there, this is important. I should have put it in red. That process of a first messenger that's trapped outside the cell causing a second messenger to develop inside the cell, we call that signal transduction. So that signal that's trapped outside the cell actually becomes a signal inside the cell via this process that we call signal transduction. All right, so I think we're going to we just got a couple more slides left. We're going to continue this with on Tuesday. I don't know if I can finish everything up. So then you got a test schedule for Thursday, huh? That might be a little short for you guys. I'll keep an open mind over the weekend where we're going to have that test. All right, so don't get your feelings hurt if we postpone it. You have to be flexible in here. Okay, so that's it for lecture today.